This is The Reason Interview, where we go deep with the artists, entrepreneurs, and academics who are making the world more libertarian, or at least a little more interesting. I'm Eric Boehm, filling in for Nick Gillespie. This week, our guest is Colleen Shogan, the former archivist of the United States and the editor of an upcoming essay series about America's presidents. Her In Pursuit series includes essays from the likes of John Roberts, Barack Obama, and George W. Bush, whose piece on George Washington will kick off the series in February. In our conversation, Shogan discusses her appreciation for some of America's lesser-known commanders-in-chief, the confusing circumstances surrounding her dismissal as the head of the National Archives, and why America needs institutions that can remain outside the partisan fray. And now, The Reason Interview with Colleen Shogan. Colleen Shogan, thanks for talking to Reason.
I'm happy to be here.
So you are a former archivist of the United States, I believe the 11th archivist of the United States, if my information is correct. And as government titles go, I got to say that's one of the coolest ones. Like it's not quite Chief Justice, but it's in the top five for me. We're going to talk about why you are a former archivist of the United States and the circumstances regarding your departure there. We'll talk about that a little bit later. I'm also very eager to chat about your new project, which is a series of essays titled In Pursuit. That is tied to the 250th anniversary of the country. And here we are in the beginning of 2026, beginning that celebration. We'll get to that shortly as well. But I wanted to start today by talking about that awesome title that you held for a few years. I've never gotten to interview an archivist before, and I'm not sure that I ever will again. So let's start there. Aside from the obvious, which I assume is preventing Nick Cage from stealing the Declaration of Independence, what does the archivist of the United States do?
Well, it is a great title, but it's an actual real job. It's not an honorific position. Sometimes people ask me that question. The Archivist of the United States is just like, the Secretary of State or anything else, any other head of a government agency. The Archivist of the United States runs the National Archives and Records Administration, which is an agency situated in the executive branch that is responsible for all of the records of the United States. And so the archivist is responsible for the caretaking of those records, making them accessible to as many Americans as possible, and of course, fostering trust in the custody of those records as they tell the history of the United States and the history of our Democratic Republic.
And how did you end up in that role? This is something that I imagine you weren't like aspiring to as a young child or anything like that. But how do you end up as the archivist of the United States?
I'm not an archivist by training. I'm not even a librarian by training. I'm actually a political scientist. I have a PhD in political science. And I've had a really interesting career, kind of the type of career that you can only have at a place like Washington, D.C., where your career can take, your professional career can take many twists and turns. I came to Washington, D.C., the Washington, D.C. area, after I got my PhD in political science from Yale, and I started my career as a professor of political science, an assistant professor of political science at George Mason University, right outside of Washington, D.C., in Fairfax, Virginia. And it's a terrific school. And quite frankly, when I got that job, I was so thrilled to have it, teaching American politics at George Mason at a time when it can be very difficult to secure a tenure track position at a R1, a research university. I thought that I would probably be at George Mason for the rest of my life, or the rest of my career. And I probably would have, but I was about 4 years into my contract with George Mason. And I was teaching all these great students from the Washington, D.C. area, and almost all of them had real-life government experience in some way, shape, or form. They had either interned in an executive branch agency, they had worked in an agency, they had worked on Capitol Hill, or they had worked at a nonprofit, and I had gone straight through. I had had a really great academic career, but I went right from undergraduate to graduate school, and I had taken no time off to work in the public or private sector in between. And so I felt like I started to feel like when I was in the classroom, that I had a little bit of a disadvantage or a deficiency. But there was a remedy for that that I knew a lot about, which is the American Political Science Association Congressional Fellowship, which is a terrific program still ongoing, which takes four or five political scientists every year, which are in academia, who are in academia, and allows them to work on Capitol Hill for a full year and then come back to their positions. So I applied for the fellowship. I got it. And I went off to Capitol Hill thinking that I would spend a year getting some real life government, political, and congressional experience, and then come back and stand for tenure and continue on my way, my career in academia. But that was not to be the case because I got into public service as a congressional fellow. I worked for Senator Lieberman from Connecticut. And it was just, it was just intoxicating to me. The office that I worked in, Senator Lieberman, was an office focused on public service. There were people all around me who had come from different walks of life. The person that I worked closely with was a retired Army colonel who was running the defense portfolio for Senator Lieberman at the time. He had had an entire career in the military before coming to work in the United States Senate. And I was so inspired by the stories that surrounded me from that staff that when my time came up at the end of the year and Senator Lieberman asked if I would stay and I would accept a permanent full-time position on his staff, I decided that I would because I thought I could go back to academia at some point later in my life, but I was never going to be able to go back to the Senate. And that really started me on my career in public service. I stayed in the Senate for, I think, another year and a half. And then I went to the Library of Congress at the Congressional Research Service, where I was for 8 years. And I became the deputy director eventually of CRS. And then I was moved into senior leadership at the Library of Congress, which is where I really started to understand what it means to work in a nonpartisan cultural institution. Those years spent in senior leadership at the Library of Congress and spent 4 years working under both James Billington and Carla Hayden in those roles. And then I moved to the White House Historical Association, which was my first time out of government service, which the White House Historical Association is a nonpartisan nonprofit that works alongside the White House, but it is not a government agency in itself or a government program in itself. And I went to White House Historical when President Trump was in office in his first term in 2020, and then stayed there. And of course, President Biden came into office and in 2021. And that's where I got on the radar for the White House for the nomination to become the Archivist of the United States.
So the job of Archivist, you mentioned how you're not a librarian by training, not necessarily a historian by training either. I imagine that job is, it's a little bit of both of those things. It's sort of like you said, it's, you know, almost like a cabinet secretary in a sense. It's a little bit of all of these things. If you could sum it up, like what is the, you know, the day-to-day work that you're doing as the Archivist? Is it more like running a museum? Is it more like running a library? Is it more like being a cabinet secretary?
That's a great question. It's kind of a combination of all of those things because in any given day, you would be doing all of those things. You are a public spokesperson for the National Archives. I took that role seriously because I thought that the National Archives, out of the three cultural institutions in the United States, the Archives, the Library of Congress, the Smithsonian Institution, I thought the Archives needed to boost its public profile. So I spent a lot of time traveling around the country to all our various presidential libraries, doing public events, appearing on podcasts just like this, appearing on radio programs, television, to try to talk about what the National Archives does. So I spent a fair amount of time in that, you know, public relations role. But then there's also day-to-day things that you have to do at the National Archives. For example, you have a federal budget. Just like, you know, any other federal agency, you have to work with the Office of Management and Budget. You have to come up with a federal budget. So I spent a lot of time making decisions about the federal budget of the National Archives and figuring out what our priorities would be. Meeting with members of Congress, which obviously perform oversight of the National Archives, and talking about what we would do. And then, of course, meeting with transparency groups that are very interested in record keeping and citizens' access to records in the United States.
Sounds like a really interesting job. We will talk some more about what you did there and about some of the controversies that you were involved in while you were the archivist a little bit later. Skip over that for now. I want to talk about this new project that you're working on now, which is called In Pursuit. It's a series of essays that I believe will run on Substack starting next year, all about the resilience of American democracy. And the very first essay, again, if I'm not mistaken, will be released on President's Day. And it is a president writing about a president. So very fitting. Tell us about that.
In Pursuit is trying to fill, I think, which ends up being a little bit of a void here in 2026. I think there's a lot of different great programs to celebrate our 250th anniversary of the United States. But even when I was the archivist of the United States, I was worried that we didn't have a large-scale national program that used history as a way for us to learn the lessons of our present and, of course, inform our future. And after I left the National Archives a few weeks later, I thought I would take a little bit of a break, quite frankly. That was a pretty, you know, intense job to have. So, you know, I was looking forward to maybe a little bit of time off. But a few weeks later, I was contacted by the organization More Perfect, which is run by John Bridgeland, who is an alum of the George W. Bush White House, of the Domestic Policy Council and National Service, leading National Service initiatives for President Bush. And I had known John Bridgeland in many of my different roles in Washington, D.C. And he said, we have this great idea for a 250th program and initiative, but we need someone to run it. And what we want to do is collect essays from about all the presidents and select first ladies. And we want to figure from, you know, really prominent, important people, historians, public figures, public intellectuals. And we want to put them together in somewhere, we don't know where. And we want to publicize them and share them with the American people. And I thought, well, that's a terrific program. I love presidents and first ladies. I obviously worked at the White House Historical Association. I wrote a dissertation on presidential leadership. I spent a lot of time at the presidential libraries. I visited every National Archives presidential library when I was the archivist of the United States. So it played into a lot of my strengths. And I was really impressed by the team that John Bridgeland had pulled together at More Perfect. So after a couple of conversations, I was persuaded to come on board and lead this project. And I'm so happy that I did. And you're right. Our first essay is going to debut on President's Day here in 2026, just in about 6 weeks from now. And it's going to be President Bush writing an essay on George Washington. And these are short essays, only 1,200 words. And every essay has one lesson we can learn from this president or first lady. And they're going to debut on Substack so that they are free and accessible to anybody who wants to read them.
I'm glad to hear that you gave them a word count, because I think parameters are really important for good writing to begin with, and especially when you're dealing with politicians, right? You have to make sure they cut it off at a certain point. The Gettysburg Address is famous because it is so succinct.
That's right.
You've got a really remarkable set of authors here. Tell us about some of the others. I know John Roberts is involved, Barack Obama, and a number of really interesting people.
So we have three former presidents: President Bush writing on George Washington, President Clinton is writing on Teddy Roosevelt, and President Obama on Abraham Lincoln. We have three former first ladies. Laura Bush is writing on Lady Bird Johnson, her fellow Texan. Michelle Obama on Jackie Kennedy, and Hillary Clinton on Eleanor Roosevelt. And as you said, Chief Justice Roberts is, of course, writing on William Howard Taft, who he's, you know, very eager to share, you know, Taft's interesting career trajectory. That we think of Taft as this president, you know, that sandwiched between Wilson and TR, but we forget that he was the Chief Justice of the United States and, you know, had some of the most, really the most important parts of his career after he left the White House, after he left the presidency. We have, you know, terrific historians, some academic historians that are very well known, like David Blight and Karen Wolf and Annette Gordon Reed, but also, you know, some popular historians that people read, Richard Norton Smith and John Meacham and Michael Beschloss and many others. that are beloved by many Americans, collectively, all of their books participating. And some journalists as well, well-respected journalists, I think from a variety of perspectives are participating in the project.
Yeah, Taft, I think the only guy to ever pull off that that double, mm-hmm. right? The Chief Justice and President of the United States. Very impressive. Looking forward to see what Roberts has to say about him. Is there an overall theme that emerged here? Was there an attempt to have a theme from the outset, or was this a, you know, let's just get these people to share their thoughts with us and then just see where it goes?
There were just a few, you know, ground rules. The first one you've already hit upon, which was they had to be short, 1,200 to 1,250 words. And the reason for that was I want people to be able to read these, you know, in the morning when you're having a cup of coffee before you got to get to work, or at lunchtime when you have, you know, 15 or 20 minutes, or before or after you put your kids to bed at night. I don't, you know, not everybody has a lot of time to read an 800-page biography of a president or a first lady, but they do have time to read 1,200 words. So that was an important part of the project. The other thing was these lessons, and that's really the heart of In Pursuit, is that every essay really has to encapsulate one accessible and relevant lesson that we can learn from this individual, this person's leadership. And that can be a success. It can be, you know, stemming from a failure. It can be from any episode in that person's leadership or history. But we want them to be relevant lessons so that all Americans can read these essays and see themselves in them. Even if you're not, you know, involved in politics, you're not a historian, you know, you're some other profession or some other vocation that's completely different from that, you can read these essays and learn something from them, hopefully that will be relevant to your own life and something that you'll learn about the history of the United States that informs our future. And of course, we asked all of the essays to be strictly nonpartisan. We know that people have a lot of opinions today about our leadership in Congress, in the White House, in the Supreme Court, and they have ideological viewpoints that they bring to the table. But I made it very clear that the In Pursuit was not the project for you in which to, you know, to project those views or beliefs. This was going to be strictly nonpartisan.
Yeah, you mentioned that that's an important goal, and that's something that you were stressing here. I think that's really important that it's not just bipartisan. It's not just that you have Barack Obama and George Bush writing here, but you've got this sort of nonpartisan theme. Spell that out a little bit more for us. Why was that distinction so important for you? And like in the moment that we're experiencing right now, where like literally everything is becoming so politicized, I can't take it, honestly. Why is that element of this so important to you?
Well, I think that, you know, even when I was the archivist, some people questioned whether or not we could engage with history in a way that was objective and nonpartisan, that didn't allow hyper-partisanship or ideology to seep in. And quite frankly, I'd made my entire career in no matter what position I had been in, whether I was at the Congressional Research Service or the White House Historical Association, all of these agencies, all of these organizations had one thing in common, which was we approached whatever we were doing, whether it was policy analysis or historical analysis, with a nonpartisan lens and viewpoint. So, you know, there was one thing that I was confident in, it was my ability to be able to do that because I was trained very well in order to be able to engage in research in that way and engage in writing in that way. So when that was part of, when I talked to John Bridgeland and others who were leading this project, Anita McBride, former chief of staff for Laura Bush, and then Mark Updegrove, who leads the LBJ Foundation in Austin, Texas. When I also talked to them, they were also likewise very interested in trying to lead a nonpartisan project that included bipartisan participants. And I was very confident that we would be able to do that. And when I asked people to do it, they were happy about it. They were excited about it. Even people that have opinions, that write opinion pieces and appear on television all the time talking about their opinions, which is fine. That's great. We want people to do that in a democracy. But when I explained this was not the venue for it, we were going to engage in history in this way so we could generate trustedness. We could engage in people from both sides of the aisle who would want to read these essays, that there would be this legitimacy of the project. Everyone was on board, and no one objected to that approach or questioned it. In fact, people welcomed it.
Well, that's really great to hear, and this sounds awesome. I'm really excited to read these essays when they start rolling out. I don't want to ask for too many spoilers here, but I do want like a little tidbit. Was there a particular essay or a particular story that came out of this that surprised you that you didn't expect, or maybe from an author who wasn't one of the big names in the project?
Well, I mean, I will say one thing. Andrew Davenport, who maybe isn't a household name, but he is a senior historian at Monticello, at Thomas Jefferson's Monticello in Charlottesville. He wrote an extraordinarily well-written essay about Thomas Jefferson. And I would say a wholly original essay on Thomas Jefferson. And believe me, there's been a lot written about Thomas Jefferson, by a lot of different people, have a lot of different viewpoints. And I thought that Andrew did an extraordinary job with Jefferson, and an extraordinary even-handed job with Jefferson, with the idea that, yes, Thomas Jefferson, his history with slavery at Monticello is not something that we can forget, but he also wrote the Declaration of Independence. So how do we square those two facts? And how do we think about those two facts objectively? And I think Andrew gives us a new way in which to think about that, which is a terrific contribution in itself. And then there's going to be great essays all across the board. The other thing I will say is that deliberately, I tried to recruit really good historians to write some of the essays on presidents who are not considered our most successful presidents. So David Blight from Yale has written a really enlightening essay on Franklin Pierce. Drew Faust on James Buchanan. Annette Gordon-Reed on Andrew Johnson. I was so excited when I read Annette Gordon-Reed, when I started to dig into her bio, which of course everybody knows her work on Thomas Jefferson and the legacy of Thomas Jefferson. But when I looked at her CV, when I found out that she had written a book earlier in her career on Andrew Johnson, I said, oh my goodness, Annette Gordon-Reed is going to write my essay on Andrew Johnson if I can persuade her to do it, because she's the perfect person to be able, she knows Andrew Johnson, she will be able to treat his story and history fairly and be able to put it in the proper context. So I think some of these presidents that we don't consider to be our most successful presidents will also have some of the most interesting and revelatory essays.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear you say that. That was actually the next thing I was going to ask you about, was exactly that. I think that it's probably easy to find people to write about Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, write the Teddy Roosevelt, the big names in history. But I'm actually, I think, more interested to read what you've put together here for the presidents that we either think of as failures or the ones that we just plain forget about. I don't know if you watched the Netflix miniseries that was going around late last year, Death by Lightning, the one about James Garfield.
Well, I love Garfield. I was one of the people that got the plaque put on the National Mall to commemorate the place where he was shot. Because I don't know if you know, before that, there was nothing anywhere to commemorate where Garfield was shot. And after reading Candace Millard's extraordinary book on Garfield, a bunch of us got together and said, we got to figure this out. And so we went to the National Park Service, and they were very receptive to it, and working with them, we're able to put a wayside on very near, not exact location, because it's actually like right in the middle of Constitution Avenue, probably where he was shot. So it had to be like a little bit off kilter at the National Gallery of Art in the space there. But it's almost approximately the place where Garfield was shot, to commemorate that location. So I was so excited when they took Candace's book and they made it into a Netflix series so more people can learn the extraordinary story of James Garfield.
Yeah, you've got Garfield, you've got Chester Arthur, who comes after him. There's this whole chunk there after the Civil War of presidents, many of whom only served one term, and then they were out and came back again. I mean, that are just sort of glossed over. Maybe this is my own, ignorance of this part of American history. I don't know, but I get the sense that there's just like this section of presidents that we had between Lincoln and Teddy Roosevelt, basically more or less, who are kind of forgotten about. And I'm really interested to see what we've got in this essay selection about those guys. That's really
right. I recruited my dissertation advisor, Stephen Skronik, to write on Rutherford D. Hayes, because Skronik wrote one of the most important books ever on the construction of the American state, the construction of the American bureaucracy, of the bureaucracy, the federal bureaucracy. And of course, we know Hayes was instrumental in leadership of that. So, you know, we're going to learn some of those stories as well that are lesser known.
Yeah, so much of that, and a lot of that era seems relevant today. I'm thinking about this not just because of some of the themes in the Garfield show, but also we hear a lot of comparisons of Trump to McKinley, for example, and this sort of Spanish-American War era America, echoes of that coming back now. It's like these moments in our history continue to be relevant. They're not just names and dates and facts in a history book, but they do sort of echo through, you know, the events that are happening right now.
Yeah, Karl Rove has written the essay on McKinley. Of course, he's written a whole book on McKinley, and he was one of the early supporters of this project, actually writing a test essay for John Bridgeland to show that, you know, what this project could look like, so there could be early support and funding for the project. So Karl Rove was instrumental to helping this project get off the ground with his McKinley essay.
Yeah, I want to mention a couple of the other authors here, one of whom, Carla Hayden, you mentioned earlier, former Librarian of Congress. There's also Lonnie Bunch, Secretary of the Smithsonian, or former Secretary of the Smithsonian. I don't know if she's still there.
Bunch is still the Secretary of the Smithsonian.
That's right, yeah. Mm-hmm. They're not necessarily household names, even for people who follow politics. I had to double check, obviously, just now what their positions are. But they have also been targets of the current administration in various ways, rhetorically, or maybe going beyond just the rhetoric. Tell us, like, did that influence their contributions here? Is that part of why they were selected?
Well, I mean, you know, Carla Hayden and Lonnie Bunch are two of my friends. I served alongside them when I was the archivist. You know, certainly Dr. Hayden was the Librarian of Congress, and Lonnie Bunch is still the Secretary of the Smithsonian. And they were two of the earliest people that I went to recruit for this project, because no one understands how to do nonpartisan history better than Carla Hayden or Lonnie Bunch, because they certainly lived it in both of their roles. And Dr. Hayden is writing appropriately the essay on Laura Bush, because, of course, Laura Bush is a librarian. And Carla Hayden is also a librarian. And they, you know, the National Book Festival at the Library of Congress was started by Laura Bush in conjunction with Dr. Hayden's predecessor, Dr. Billington. So that made a lot of sense. I'm just really excited that we're able to include them in this project.
I think I may have misgendered Lonnie Bunch a moment ago. I said she. It's a he, Lonnie. Yes. Apologies for that. Just a slip of the tongue. As using that as a kind of transition here, we have to get around to talking about some of the controversies you were involved in your departure from the National Archives. You actually were, this is impressive, because it's usually only libertarians who get attacked by both the left and the right within the span of like 4 months. But this happened to you too. You went through this this period of time. So we have to talk about this a bit. All kind of kicked off, I suppose, in October of 2024. The Wall Street Journal ran a story claiming that you were in your role as archivist at the time, sort of censoring parts of American history, things involving Martin Luther King Jr. and Native Americans. Can you just sort of set the record straight for us here? What was your involvement in reviewing or approving or changing exhibits that were at the National Archives when you were running things?
Well, thanks for that question. And I think it's appropriate you ask that question, because today the Wall Street Journal ran an article that reviewed the exhibit that I led and said it was extraordinary, and said it was one of the best examples of civic education in a museum in the United States. So I don't really understand it, quite frankly, because the Wall Street Journal ran an article on me a year ago, you know, accusing me of whitewashing history. And today they wrote a very different type of article saying that the exhibit that I led was, you know, an example, a perfect example of what the 250th anniversary should be all about. So I don't know, maybe you should ask the Wall Street Journal about why they changed their opinion so much. I think the answer to that was that they got the story wrong in the first place. That is the answer to the question. I never removed any object or any record from any exhibit at the National Archives, except for regular rotations that have to take place, which happens all the time, as you know, in any museum or exhibit. Sure. But I never removed any picture of anyone or any record or any video of any figure in American history. What happened was when I came to the National Archives, there was a longstanding permanent exhibit at the National Archives. Within like 2 or 3 months after I arrived, that exhibit was removed because it was scheduled to be removed. And there was a whole new exhibit that was going to be built in its place. And I did start with a blueprint for that new exhibit that had been worked on by my predecessor, David Ferriero, which basically gave, you know, he'd worked on it with a group of historians, what basically gave the different rooms in the exhibit, the different themes that would be covered in the exhibit. And it's supposed to be the permanent exhibit that would last another 20 years at the National Archives because of the amount of money that was going to be spent to create that exhibit. But there was really not that much else done. There was no content that had been finalized for any parts of the exhibit. It was my job to work with our curators and our records specialists and our senior leadership in order to fill out that plan, that blueprint, so that we could get to work and create the exhibit that is now in place at the National Archives. And that's what we did. I was involved in all aspects of that exhibit creation. There's no doubt about it. There was not a meeting where decisions were made that I did not attend or I did not participate in or I did not review. I reviewed every label that is in that exhibit that is in the National Archives today. Every piece of every sentence, every label, I reviewed personally. We would go room by room and I would look at it and I would, you know, through my knowledge as a political scientist and someone who has studied American history, we would have discussions and about what was going to be included or not. And some of the decisions that went into that was, particularly for the National Archives, where there's only a small amount of exhibit space, were there episodes of American history that were covered in other exhibits? Okay. There's a permanent exhibit called the Record of Rights, which is known as the Rubenstein Gallery. As soon as you walk in, has the Magna Carta, a copy of the Magna Carta, which is the featured component of that exhibit. But it's really about the history of rights in the United States and the expansion of rights. So we wanted to make sure we didn't duplicate any of the stories that were in Records of Rights in the upstairs exhibit, because we only really had those two permanent exhibits to work with. So some of the changes that were made because some of the suggestions that came to me were actually already covered in Records of Rights. But we substituted them with I think, suitable stories about American history that were inclusive of all Americans. And in fact, the Wall Street Journal today called the exhibit an inclusive exhibit that shows the diversity of the United States and the diversity of the American story.
Well, we're glad to see them setting the record straight. And I have to say, I'm sure most of our listeners who are from the D.C. area are very familiar with the National Archives. But for those of us or for those of you out there who have not been to D.C. or haven't been to the National Archives, I absolutely recommend it. It is I think it's one of my two or three favorite museums on the Mall with the Smithsonian. And in particular, you mentioned the Magna Carta and that the Rubenstein Gallery there on the first floor when you come in. Yes, the Declaration of Independence is upstairs. Yes, the Constitution is upstairs. Those are the big attractions. That's really awesome. The space that's in is very, very cool. But like the first time I was in there and I saw the copy of the Magna Carta that's there from, what is it, the 1200s or the 1300s?
Right.
And that's That's remarkable to think about, like, okay, yes, we have kind of the definitive version of the statements, and not even definitive because we've perfected it over time. We've added to it. We've amended it over time. But to think about, okay, these ideas, there were people thinking about these ideas even before America, and think about where that came from is really cool. And that whole exhibit that starts in the 1300s and goes all the way up to modern day is really fantastic. The whole space is really great. I imagine this whole thing became a huge controversy, though, just because it happened in 2024. If the Wall Street Journal had written that story 5 years ago, no one would have cared. Or 10 years ago, no one would have cared.
Right.
Will Bunch, a columnist in Philadelphia, who I've had a couple run-ins with over the years as well, accused you of obeying fascism in advance. I don't know. What did you think when you heard, when this became such a big story last year, kind of out of the blue? Were you surprised to see this becoming such a political controversy?
Absolutely. I mean, I couldn't recognize myself in what people were saying about me. I was also, you know, the vice chair. We didn't talk about this. I was the vice chair of the Women's Suffrage Centennial Commission. I was, you know, part of a bipartisan commission to celebrate the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment. Prior to becoming the archivist, I was the chairman of the board of the foundation to build the monument for women's suffrage. Now I'm back at the Monument Foundation. I'm the co-chair of the board, along with Jovita Carranza, who served in the first term of the Trump administration in his cabinet. So, I mean, I had always practiced, you know, the idea of being careful about telling stories of American history, about being sure that we are telling both our successes and being honest about the times in the United States when we failed to live up to the promises made in the Declaration of Independence. How are we supposed to appreciate the words in the Declaration of Independence and everything that we aspire to if we don't understand the times in which we've fallen short? So when I would read these comments on social media, it was almost, I mean, obviously these people did not know me. They were not familiar with me or my leadership, but it was almost like they were talking about a person, that I didn't know. And it certainly didn't describe me. Thankfully, I had some people that came, you know, to defend me, which was very nice. The National Review was, really had thought I got a raw deal. And some other people wrote some kind comments as well. But it was a very difficult episode. And I would just urge people, when you read something in a journalistic outlet, I'm not undermining journalism at all. But you really got to do your due diligence. If you think, wow, that seems kind of unusual. Why would someone who was appointed by President Biden or nominated rather by President Biden, why would she be censoring history? Maybe you should check it out for yourself, because sometimes journalists don't get it right.
Yeah, don't believe everything you read in the papers, and certainly don't believe everything you see on Twitter. Now, I suppose if you were engaging in any sort of, I don't know, calculated political subterfuge here, you must have done a bad job at it, because Trump fired you not long after he took office. So you were getting it from both sides at this point. How did you find out you were getting canned? Did you get any sort of notification ahead of time, or did you find out when he tweeted it out, or when he said to a reporter, we're firing the archivist?
Yeah, I mean, I found out, it was a Friday evening. It was about an hour after David Rubenstein had been fired as the chair of the Kennedy Center. And I saw that come through and I said, wow, that's strange, because, Rubenstein has a relationship with President Trump. So that seemed a little odd to me. And then an hour later, one of my senior staff members actually texted me and said there was a tweet on social media from the head of White House personnel saying that I had been fired. I had been relieved of my duties. And then I looked on my work phone and I saw that I had also an email from him saying the same.
Do you think you were just kind of collateral damage in this Trump revenge tour? Do you think, does he have some secret beef with you that the world doesn't know about, that we should know about? Like, spill the tea here for us.
I absolutely do not. He has no beef with me. In fact, I worked with President Trump at the White House Historical Association. I worked with Mrs. Trump at the White House Historical Association and Mrs. Trump extensively with the Women's Suffrage Centennial. She was my guest at the National Archives. She came and spoke at a naturalization ceremony because she is, of course, only the second foreign-born first lady in American history, besides Louisa Adams. And so what better guest can you have than Mrs. Trump to talk about the importance of naturalization at the National Archives? And that was because of my pre-existing relationship with her that she accepted my invitation to come and speak at the National Archives when I was the archivist. So I certainly have no previous bad blood between myself and President Trump. And I certainly didn't do anything wrong when I was archivist. I always paid particular attention to follow the law and, of course, implement the law and regulations concerning records in a nonpartisan way. So I don't understand the motivation, quite frankly, of why he fired me. There's been no public explanation for why he fired me. And I continue to be in the dark on that one.
I think if I can put forth a theory here, it's related to what you just said about following the law regarding records. And look, the National Archives was sort of kind of tangentially involved, I guess, in the one Trump indictment involving the classified documents. And the president has boxes of material, boxes of stuff that he took from the White House that the FBI finds in Mar-a-Lago, stuffed in a bathroom. All of that. We don't need to rehash all of that here. But I guess my question to you as the former National Archivist would be, like, why do we need that stuff? And I am in favor of transparency. I'm in favor of government and accountability and all of that. But like, if the president wants to keep boxes of stuff in a bathroom for reasons that we can't even fathom, why is it in the interest of America? Why is it in the interest of all of us that we have access to that? Why does the archives need access to that?
Right. So, I mean, it is law in the Presidential Records Act. So it has been, you know, enacted and has been enforced since it was signed under President Carter. And it went into effect starting with President Reagan. So from there forward, presidential records are not the property of anybody, of presidents of the United States or any one individual. They are the property of the American people. And the reason, of course, this is an aftermath from Watergate. That's the Presidential Records Act is in reaction to that. The idea that the American people in a large democracy like the United States, just for the reasons that you just expounded, that accountability and transparency is essential for legitimacy of government. And so there is all kinds of protections within the Presidential Records Act about the number of years in which, you know, records become accessible and that the public can gain access, and the Freedom of Information Act is applicable. So there's all kinds of protections that give a little bit of space from an administration. So it doesn't mean that the day after you leave the White House that everybody gets access to, you know, all the records that you created when you're president of the United States. That's not the case at all. There's a five-year window that provides a little bit of breathing room. It gives the National Archives time to make sense of the records and start to get them in some semblance of shape from an archival purpose. But it also gives a little bit of space for that executive decision-making that took place in the White House. But then starting after year five and then going forward, there starts to be more and more access provided to the American people, because the decisions of our leaders have to be accessible to the American people. Once again, it just comes back to what we're trying to do within Pursuit. We need to be able to evaluate and examine the decisions of our leaders so that we can write good histories about them, learn from the decisions that were made so that we can think about our present and our future in critical ways, ways that both would be affirming in many cases and ways in some ways in which we might question of those decisions and look back at them. So it's essential. It's actually without that transparency and accountability, I would say you are undermining a key component of the legitimacy of a democratic government, not just in the United States, but any Democratic government.
Yeah, and I like to think that we get better decisions too, right? That by just the knowledge that whatever is, you know, whatever you're doing as president is going to be public someday, not immediately, but someday. I would think that probably weighs in some way on the decisions that are made.
If you think you're doing a good job, like a lot of our presidents think they do, you want to have those records available, sure, because those records are going to show why you made the decisions that you did and the process that you undertook for those decisions. So it helps your story many, many years from now, when everybody that worked for you in the White House is dead and gone, that it helps to allow your story to continue to be told.
Sure. And then for all the rest of us and future generations to learn, like you said, not just from the successes, but from the failures, or learn that process, maybe what looks like an unpopular decision in the moment is actually the right one.
That's
in
true.
The long term. To come back around to the issue of partisanship, we've talked about this a few times, too. It seems to me that, like, our political culture is obviously out of control. We've even at this point politicized the archivist of the United States, which is, you know, as we talked about earlier, it's a combination of librarian and historian, very nonpartisan function, should be a nonpartisan function. Like, what does it say about the state of the country and about our political culture that all of this happened to you, but more importantly, that all of this happened to the National Archives?
Well, I do think it's an unfortunate development, and I am concerned, what happened to me is one thing. I mean, obviously, I'm doing really well. I enjoy my role with In Pursuit. I also work at Stand Together, helping them with their civics education and their new initiatives in civics education. And I'm continuing to do all the things that I did as archivist of the United States and have the platform in order to be able to do it. But my concern is with the institutions, because what I'm really concerned about is that, okay, I mean, you know, Secretary Rubio is the acting archivist. I don't know, you know, he may be in there for the entirety of President
Trump's
term.
Do you think he's doing a lot of work in that role? Do you think he's getting the job done?
I don't know. I don't know much about the day to day. So I hate to speculate on things, because when I don't, you know, talk to people, I don't know. All I know is that I worked much more than 40 hours a week, every week that I was at the National Archives. It was more than a full-time job in order to lead that institution if you do it properly. And so, that's what I will say about that. But I'm very concerned about what will happen in the future to places like the Archives, the Library of Congress, the Smithsonian, because what these institutions should not be is a political seesaw back and forth. Okay, so we're going to have a Democratic president, you know, sometime in the future from the Democratic Party. And so we'll have a Democratic archivist, and we'll have a Democratic head of the Smithsonian and the Library of Congress. And then 4 years later, we'll swing back, and then we'll put a Republican in all these positions. That is not how it's supposed to be. These institutions benefit from leadership that exists across administrations, because there are projects that need to be undertaken at these institutions that require long-term planning. And they are best led when they are led by people that are going to be in there for 6 years, 8 years, 10 years across the board. And I think the idea that we have now, you know, removed both myself and Carla Hayden from our roles, we're setting a dangerous precedent for the future. We have come to expect these institutions to be nonpartisan, okay? And if we remove that from our ecosystem, we're really giving something up as a democracy. It's problematic.
Are there any like concrete steps you think we could take to change that, to fix that? What would you propose? Because like the solution to me is obviously just depoliticize these things, but I don't know. I could wish for that all day. I don't
right.
think it's going to happen.
I mean, it's what worked up until this do? Point. So, I mean, the norms and procedures have worked up to this point. The Archivist of the United States says very clearly can only be selected in a way that is without attention to politics or partisanship, only on the qualifications of that person. It's explicitly stated in the statute. When I was removed from my duties, there was supposed to be notification to Congress to explain from the president why he removed me. But that was never executed. That was never done. The reason why that is in statute is because it was to prevent the president of the United States removing an archivist solely for political purposes. I think you can strengthen the statute to make it absolutely explicitly clear that the archivist can only be removed for, you know, malfeasance or dereliction of duty. And you could require Congress to concur with the president. Mm. The National Archives also holds in trust the records of the Supreme Court and the records of the legislative branch of government. It's in this executive branch, but it really isn't just an executive branch agency. So why not include the legislative branch to have to concur with the president if the archivist would have to be removed? And I guarantee you, if that had happened, if that was in place, I would have not been removed from my position.
Yeah, I think so. Like so many of our problems, it comes down to Congress has to fight for these things. Like, right, that change you're proposing would have to be implemented by Congress, and then would require further action by Congress. And Congress just seems like it's out to lunch right now. Like we've kind of lost that the jealously guarding their powers situation that was kind of foundational to, you know, to the Constitution, to that document that used to live in the same building where you worked. That seems to be missing now, and that's really the root of a lot of these institutional problems.
Rand Paul was on your podcast, you know, with Nick Gillespie. And I thought he said it in a perfect way. Rand Paul said that, you know, in the Federalist, Madison wrote, ambition must counteract ambition. But we need ambition from both branches of government in order for that to be able to work. So we need, I would say, we need Congress to be ambitious and to be confident in their duties. They are the first branch of government for a reason. They're the most powerful branch of government. They have the all the power of the people behind them. And so, you know, they can undertake difficult things like looking at these types of statutes so that we can prevent some of these things from happening again.
Yeah. And in the absence of Congress doing that, it seems like we'll just see the executive continue to ignore whether it's, you know, the war powers rules or whether it's, hey, you got to notify Congress when you fire the archivist. These rules are just continually being ignored. I want to ask before we let you go about one other controversy, kind of in a similar theme that erupted during your tenure from the Biden administration, actually. And of course, it was President Joe Biden who appointed you. And we love it here at Reason when people get into fights with different presidential administrations. So, again, kudos to you for this.
Clearly, when you've been able to catch ire from both sides of the aisle, I hate to say it, but it means that I was actually doing my job. You know,
I think that's right. I think that's true for journalists as well. Like that's the way I look at it. If I get people on both sides complaining, then we've done the job. During your confirmation hearing, you were asked about the Equal Rights Amendment and whether that should be regarded as having been ratified. I believe you said no. You can clarify that for me if you have a different answer on this. But then Joe Biden, right before he left office, just like by tweet, said, "Okay, the Equal Rights Amendment is now part of the Constitution." Can you clarify for us first and foremost that that's not how the Constitution gets amended? And then why is that happening? Why did that happen?
You would have to ask President Biden on that one. I mean, I don't know. There were forces that must have came to be that influenced him to change his opinion, because that was certainly not the opinion that was presented to me by the White House when I was the nominee. I was presented with the Office of Legal Counsel in the Department of Justice, their opinion, which was very similar to the Trump administration's opinion in the first Trump term. It did say that, you know, they're barring action from Congress and or the judiciary, which is true. I would have abided by a court order. I would have had to think about things if Congress had amended the statute, the limitations, for the ratification of the ERA, which it did not. But neither of those things happened, which I said clearly in my confirmation hearing. So there was no way that I could publish the Equal Rights Amendment as part of the Constitution of the United States. I've said this before, but I think it's worth repeating again. When you come into these offices, like I had the honor and privilege to serve as the archivist of the United States, you stand up and you take an oath of office. I took a private oath whenever I started, and then I took a public oath with the Chief Justice of the United States swearing me in. And I swore to uphold the Constitution of the United States, not to listen to any given president or any given member of Congress or any other politician, but to uphold the Constitution of the United States. And I'm a political scientist. I can read. I've read the Constitution. I've read the Federalist many times. I've taken courses on the Federalist. So I understand how the Constitution of the United States is amended. President Biden is absolutely, you know, he had the right to his opinion that he thought that the ERA was part of the Constitution of the United States. But that opinion did not influence me to act in a particular way. I knew that I was the constitutional officer that was entrusted with that decision, and I took it seriously. It was not, again, not a pleasant experience to have pressure on you from particularly the president that had put forward your nomination. But he also didn't order me to publish the amendment either, which kind of tells you that his statement was more of a rhetorical demonstration or statement, not one in which he was trying to tell me what I needed to do. So there is a distinction there.
I bring it up, I think, just to make, and we've talked about this already, but I mean to make the point about there are consequences to the politicization of these offices. You have a nonpartisan person potentially running something like the National Archives, and then it's in theory, at least, much easier for a president to force through some sort of obviously very political, somewhat rhetorical decision like that. Not saying it would be, you know, a decision about amending the Constitution, but there are other potential consequences there.
That's correct. I mean, and someone who, like me, who had been trained as a nonpartisan leader in other positions and other jobs, I mean, in some ways, I was built for that moment, I had seen things when I was at the Library of Congress. You know, there was obviously, there's always, you know, controversies about politics here or there. Certainly at the White House Historical Association, an amazing organization that withstands, you know, no matter who is in office, to be able to work with the preservation and history of the White House. So if anybody was going to be independent-minded and try to do the right thing, I kind of felt like, you know, in some ways, my whole life led up to that moment. And I took no great pleasure in it because I happen to be a supporter of the Equal Rights Amendment. But I also think that the Equal Rights Amendment needs to be in the Constitution in the right way, so that it is legitimate and is considered a legitimate part of the Constitution.
Yeah, 100% agree with all of that. Colleen, this has been a wonderful conversation. I suppose in some way I actually have to be thankful that you got fired, because we're going to get this awesome essay series in pursuit. We got to have this conversation. We're really looking forward to reading those essays when they come out later this year. Like, I'm actually like thrilled about this. I think just having the chance to go back through presidential history in these specific lenses is going to be really wonderful. Before we let you go, though, one last thing. I got to get you out of here on this.
Sure.
You've also written a series of books, the Washington Whodunit series that I've come across. And I don't think many people are probably familiar with these. So they've got some amazing titles, some very alliterative titles like Stabbing in the Senate, Homicide in the House, The K Street Killing, Larceny at the Library. I assume that's the Library of Congress.
Yes.
Setting this in the places, you know. I seriously want to read these too. But I got to know, like, how did these come about? What was your, like, what's the origin story for the Washington Whodunit books? And like, was there a bet involved in this?
Well, thanks for
asking. Or was
it
a way of taking out your frustration with the political system?
Well, yeah, thanks for asking. So, I am a great reader of mysteries. I love mystery novels, and I love mystery novels particularly that have a protagonist that's not a police officer, an amateur detective at the helm. And, you know, just sort of for a relaxation, for fun, I've read mystery novels, you know, since I was like 6 or 7 years old, starting out with Encyclopedia Brown and the Hardy Boys and Nancy Drew and Trixie Belden and all of those great books. And so really the story behind these was one day I was taking a walk in my neighborhood and I had just finished reading, I don't know, another one. And my mind started to wander and I thought, well, if I wrote a mystery novel, what would the plot of that mystery novel be? And I came up with the plot of Stabbing in the Senate. And I came up with my character, Kit Marshall, right in that walk. And I did one really smart thing, which was when I came home from the walk, I wrote it all down on a piece of paper. And then a few weeks later, I told my husband about it. And he said, well, you need to write that book. That's a great idea for a book. I said, well, I haven't written a word of fiction in my entire life. I mean, really, in my entire life. He said, oh, Colleen, you've always read all these novels, all these books. You can do it. So that's what I did. I sat down and I had all these books around me and I started to pay attention to the structure of the novels. There's a lot of help online these days that, you know, if you want to write a mystery novel that, you know, can give you some of the basics. And I just started writing. And, you know, one book turned into three books, and three books turned into six books, and then six books turned into eight books. And they were such a delight to write. So thank you for asking about that.
No, really wonderful stuff. Can you give us a recommendation, not one of yours, but a recommendation of a mystery novel that you really like that other people should know more about?
Well, one great series, I just finished reading another book in it most recently, is from another author from the DC area, Ellen Crosby. And she writes a terrific series set in wine country, set in Loudoun County. And it's about a woman who owns a vineyard in Loudoun County and solves mysteries in the greater DC, Northern Virginia area. And her books, why I like them so much, first off, I really like wine. And secondly, why I like the books is they have a lot to do with history. And she deals a lot with the history of the area. So, you know, and Ellen is a terrific writer. She used to write for the Washington Post. She was a journalist earlier in her career. So if you have another recommendation for a series, you should really take a look at her books.
I will check those out. Violence at the Vineyard, maybe, yes, I hope, right. Is the title of one of them. That's great. Tell us one more time about where we can find In Pursuit when those essays start rolling out later this year.
You can find us on Substack on In Pursuit. You can also find us on inpursuit.org. And if you don't have a Substack account, just come to inpursuit.org. You can sign up via email and we'll make sure you get the essays.
Sounds good. And those start rolling out on President's Day, and then it'll be, I imagine, weekly or something like that after that.
Weekly, and for the remainder of 2026.
The rest of 2026. Happy 2026. Happy 250th birthday to America. Things are a little rough right now, but we're going to make it through. Colleen Joy Shogan, thank you so much for joining us here, and thanks for taking us through this.
Thank you.